You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maad, and this is Season 2, Episode 3. Today, I'm talking with writer and scholar W. David Marks about his book, Ametora, How Japan Saved American Style. I've known David for 15-plus years, and it's been amazing to watch him go from seriously low-key but clearly erudite blogger on Japanese culture to accomplished author with a killer book about the surprisingly complex and fascinating mechanics of post-war Japanese fashion. This episode, like all On Margins episodes, is made possible by Special Projects members. So if you're into this, please consider joining Special Projects at craigmaad.com/membership. It means a lot. Ametora is out in multiple languages, but because David is a fluent Japanese speaker, today we focused on the English and Japanese editions, the writing process for both, how complex the translation process was or wasn't, and how involved he was in getting it to market in Japan. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, David Marks. Hi. How are you doing?
Good. It's good to be in Kamakura in the studio. Well, thank you for inviting me.
Welcome to the studio. This is exciting. This is the first live interview ever in the history of On Margins, which has a long and storied history. Wow. Of 12 episodes. What's your background here? You've lived in, you grew up in the South in America.
Yep.
You have the Southern American South.
More or less. So I'm W. David Marks. I go by David. The W is just affectation and differentiation in the sense that, like, I think there's online, there's a guy who reviews books named David Marks, which is not really useful because I read a lot of books and there's a musician named David Marks and a photographer named David Marks. So I'm W. David Marks, mostly for the differentiation. I was born in Oklahoma and lived there for about 6 years, which is bizarre because I always see in my bio in Japanese, it's like from Oklahoma. And it's like, not really.
Right.
And then I was in Oxford, Mississippi for 3 years.
Okay.
Which is heart of the Deep South.
Right.
And then Pensacola, Florida for all the time up to college. And Pensacola is Florida as a technicality. We call it LA, Lower Alabama. Okay. So if you go about 20 miles west, you're in Alabama.
Okay.
And like all the TV stations are Mobile, Alabama stations and things. So it is Florida and it's on the beach more or less. I mean, it's on a bay, but it feels very, very Southern.
Okay.
So
you've got this kind of deep Southern background. And then for whatever reason, you developed an interest in not America.
Sure.
And what was the original connection to Japan? What prompted that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the not America interest is a good way to say it because in high school I studied French and German. Right. And, you know, so my parents are both more or less from the South, but like, you know, we as a family were never like, we're Southerners just because we didn't really connect with the Deep South culture so much. So growing up there, just any kind of, you know, fantasy of living elsewhere. That could be New York, that could be Boston,
sure.
That could be a different country. It was exciting. And so my parents from work started going to Japan and I think about 90 or 91. And the first time they went, they just came back kind of raving about it, but I didn't have any touch points. But the second time they came back, they brought all these souvenirs.
Okay.
And they gave me this like giant phone book manga. It was like a kid's manga.
Okay.
And they gave me these Gundam models, but the SD, so they're like the shrunken ones.
Okay.
And they had like 8 of them. They're like, just give them to your friends. And because they were like $3 a piece or something, right? And so I got really into those and just wanted to know more. Like, what is this? Because they were not just like robot shaped. They were like shaped like knights and samurai and rock stars. And like, they were really strange.
Right.
And then the manga itself, I opened it up and it was like the All Japan Dodgeball Tournament. And it was just like everything was very similar to what I knew as a kid from watching cartoons and TV, but like everything was a little bit off.
Right.
And so it felt like this really alien place. And I think another background that like we tend to often forget is if you were, I want to say 8 or 9 when the Nintendo came out.
Yeah.
And that was huge.
Yeah.
And everyone was into Super Mario. And the sense that that was a Japanese piece of hardware and software was not lost on anybody. Everybody knew it was Japanese.
Right.
And I remember being in the playground and some girl being like, my dad went to Japan and they already have Super Mario Brothers 10 there.
Yeah.
And there was a sense that like Japan was like so far advanced. And if you read there was this Nintendo Power magazine.
Sure.
And they would have all these articles about like, Dragon Quest just came out or whatever, you know, Dragon Warrior. And here's the huge line for it. And you just get the sense that like Japan was way ahead in all these things, even as a kid.
Well, I mean, I think for both of us, growing up in America in the 80s, kind of having our childhood sort of punctuated by all the stuff that was happening in the 80s, and like Japan was just present. Nintendo was this mega cultural super phenomena. Like Atari, it dwarfed all of that, right? I mean, like, I had an Atari, I had a Nintendo, and like as soon as the Nintendo arrived, it was just like Atari's dead.
Yeah.
Anything else is dead, you know? And my earliest memories of like psychosis over Christmas were related to Nintendo games. Yeah. It was like Mario, the new Mario, Mario 2 is coming out. And I think it's easy to underestimate the influence of like a country just being present in your life. Like, what other was France present in our lives like that? Were we like, you know, consuming French music when we were kids or what? No, not at all. And so I think I was never like an anime maniac, and I wasn't either. A manga maniac, and I was never like Japan. But I think there was something probably young seated in both of us. I was like, oh, there is this place that is doing interesting things.
Yeah.
And it's kind of unknowable. Because it was like, how do you get there, right? It's like, it wasn't like Europe.
Yeah.
You know, you could imagine getting to Spain or England.
Because my high school had exchange programs with Germany, programs with France. I was supposed to go to France one summer and it got canceled.
Right.
I did end up going to Germany after my senior year of high school. So Japan, I was like, I would like to go there. But I mean, the bar was low. I would go anywhere. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, I think by that point, I had been out of the country once to England because my sister was studying there. And we went there once. So sure, I'll go to Japan. And when I was 17, the university in town had a program where they sent over like 5 or 6 people. And they're mostly college students, but I got in that program. And I went for 3 weeks to a city that it's like a village called Hagiwara that's in Gifu Prefecture that is now part of the Gero Onsen. Like there's 5 of the cities kind of became Gero Onsen, which is like a very pretty mountain kind of place. It's hot mountain. For some reason, it's not cool mountain in the summer, but I was there in the August and it was really hot, but it was just incredible. It was like such a great time. And it's just a tiny place. And still it was like, wow, like all the Gundam models I can buy. And you know, I went to Nagoya. I didn't even go to Tokyo. But that was great. And you know, the other thing is I'd been studying German and French and started just dabbling and learning Japanese. And the sounds were so easy. The grammar was so easy comparatively.
Yeah.
And the feedback you get from Japanese people when you're attempting to speak Japanese, you know, it becomes kind of a cliche of like, wow, you're amazing for saying nothing, but when you're 17 and you're just like, I would like to learn your language, it's very encouraging for someone to, you know, not be like, what are you saying?
I think people underestimate, everyone's always like, Japanese is the hardest language ever in the world, but like it's actually really easy. Like there's grammatically, if you got rid of kanji
and the honorifics, but you don't even use those that much, you know,
it really would be one of the simplest.
Yeah,
it feels like
if you had been studying German.
Right.
And then, so like the summer before senior year, I went to Japan for 3 weeks. And the summer after senior year, I went to Japan, so Germany for 3 weeks. And number one, the first thing I noticed was like the first graders in the school we were in Germany, we went to their English class and their English was way better than our German.
Right, right. So immediately.
18 years old.
What do you want? Stop speaking German to me.
It's just like, I you know, was trying to speak so much German and it just like every sentence I said, there was an error in it.
Right.
Like there's no way not to make an error in a sentence. And that only encouraged me to study Japanese more because Japanese was so simplified. It's like, there's no cases to mess up. There's no, you know, articles to mess up. So that kind of got me to college. And then I was like, I'm going to study Japanese. And then my mom was like, you will absolutely hit second year and decide it's too hard and fail out. And
why did she think that?
Because her friend's kid had that
opinion. There's this weird thing, and I mean we're both basically the same age, and I think like when I went to university and I did Japanese language, the first day of the class it was this Japanese female instructor, and she was maybe like in her 50s, and she was just like, you are all going to fail. She's like, Japanese is the hardest language ever, and half of you are going to be gone in 2 weeks. And I was just like, what? And we killed it. Yeah. We just did. I got straight A's in that class. I loved it. It was so, it was like, this is not that hard. Katakana, hiragana. It took like a weekend and you kind of had it, yep. You know, it wasn't anyway. I think there's this myth. There's so many myths connected with Japan, yep. It being in the future, the language being super, super difficult, you know, yada, yada, yada. So your mom thought you weren't going to hack it out. And
I was interested in film and I was interested in Japanese, and the Japanese department was like, great, you know, let's do it. And the film department was like, oh, you do not get to make film. Do you think you get to make film? You do not. Please get out of your head that we're even going to talk to you about film. Wow. It was just very, 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 very complicated, but like they just, there was no way to go make film. So it's like, okay, I'm going to do Japanese. And I did it. And it was this weird valley between the economic boom of the early 90s and the anime boom of like 2004 or whatever.
Right.
And so when I got there, they had spent the entire 90s building up this, like, you know, getting all sorts of contributions from Japanese companies, building up the program. So they had like, you know, top-notch Japanese learning, but also all these internships you could do over in Japan. And then they had no students because like, it was like Japanese was the number one most popular freshman year language course in like the early 90s. And then in 97, everyone's like, I'm studying Chinese. You know, the future is not Japan. So, because, you know, at that point there, 95 is really where the, you know, the economy had gone bad, but then you had the sarin gas attacks and you had
the earthquake.
And it just seemed like Japan was on the outs. And so I was there like, I'm not interested in the economy. I'm just interested in the culture, but then those people hadn't really shown up yet either.
But also like this whole idea of like optimizing for who's going to be the biggest economy in 20 years just feels like, like what are you going to do? Are you going to form a bank that is only going to be worth like $4 trillion in Japan versus like $20 trillion in China? Like what is the goal of this optimization? It doesn't make any sense.
I was just there because it's like, I listened to the Japanese music and I want to know what the words meant. Like, yeah, I wasn't there to, you know, optimize my future. So, I was very lucky because there was the best internship they had for students was this internship with Kodansha, the publisher.
Nice.
And it was for juniors. And they were like, only juniors can get it. But they're like, but everyone had ceased like learning Japanese. So they had no candidates. And I, as a freshman, I was like, oh, lark, I'll just apply for it because what's the worst that can happen? And they're like, you're going into Tokyo. So I got this thing as a freshman. And they told me like, okay, like, they're on the cusp of canceling this program. So like, do good. So I got there and we did, it was 3 months and I lived in Tokyo. I barely knew anyone. And I worked at Kodansha, which means I just went there to the office and they were like, you can go sit in that corner over there.
Where was the office?
The office is in Gotokuji, which is kind of near, it's like 3 stops from Ikebukuro. It's like in Bunkyoku.
Okay. Sure.
It's like that area is just like, it's only the Kodansha office.
Right.
And I was in the manga, basically. So they put me in 6 different manga for a week, like 1 week each. And then I was in Hot Dog Press, which was like the men's fashion culture lifestyle magazine. Mm-hmm. It's like the Popeye equivalent. And then I was in Checkmate, which was like the fashion equivalent.
Okay.
And they would just stick me in a corner and be like, don't make noise and we'll maybe take you to dinner because...
Wait, but what was the job? What was the
job? Was just, I mean, it was just like a friendship to be like, come work at a Japanese company and observe.
And what did you do? Like, nothing. You go into the office and literally do nothing?
Yeah, read magazines. And then about 6 p.m. they'd be like, okay, if we take you out to dinner, we can go wherever we want to expense it to the company. So... Right. We're going to take you to eat raw horse meat because that's what we want.
That was, I remember one of the first times a Japanese buddy from university took me out, like the first year I got to Japan. He's like, we're going to go have basashi.
Yeah.
That was like, I think that's like a thing they like to just freak newbies out with. It's like, we're going to the izakaya to have raw horse sashimi.
Yeah.
And so you're like, all right.
And I was like, okay.
Sure.
Tried it. Thanks.
Wait, but so this Kodansha experience, like, did any of these connections, are you in contact with any of these people still?
No, I mean, so I'll get to how it changed my life, which is, because otherwise, you know, it was great in terms of learning Japanese. I do think like doing an internship is way better than study abroad in the sense of like, you're just forced to speak Japanese every day with Japanese people and not you're not like buddying up with all these foreign students and going out and just speaking English. So
yeah,
I like that quite a bit. What happened was I was very into Japanese indie music at the time. And it's because I had gotten into J-pop, like really straight, like the most banal poppy J-pop when I was in Japan. And I was like getting the 3-inch CDs. And it was just like a kind of cool thing to me. And then when I got back to America, I was like looking for those CDs. And even in Boston, there was like nothing. It was like no one was importing them. Or you go to the Japanese like bookstore and they would be $40 or something. Just like that I couldn't afford as a college student. And so what I did notice is I went to Newbery Comics or like a hip music store. They were importing Shonen Knife, like all these cool Japanese indie artists. And, you know, I wasn't into super pop music. I was into indie music, American indie music. And so I was like, oh, I'll just listen to Japanese indie music. So I had gotten into Planet of the Apes again, because I had watched it like as a kid, because it's always on like TBS, in the afternoons. And I was flipping through Hot Dog Press one day, and there was a t-shirt that had a face from Planet of the Apes on it. I was like, oh, I want that. That's super cool.
Right.
And I was like, where do I get that? They're like, oh, go to the store. And the store's called Nowhere. I was like, okay. So it closed at 6, and I got there, and it was like 5:15 or something. And there's just a guy outside, and he was like, you can't go in. I was like, what do you mean I can't go in? It closes at 6. He's like, you can't go in.
A Japanese guy ran?
Japanese guy. Like he's the bouncer of the store. And I was like, what is this? And so I was like determined the next day, I just like at 1 p.m. I will go and I will line up. So I get there and there's a 100-person line. And I'm waiting in line.
This is it with like 98?
This is 98. And so waiting in line, it's like, you know, horrible August heat.
Sure.
And
where in Boston is this?
This is in Harajuku.
Oh, this is not a joke. Sorry. I thought we were, for some reason, I was like, this is crazy that this is in Boston.
No, this is not.
This is in Harajuku. Great.
Summer.
Reorienting. Yeah. That's
very hot.
That's
in Harajuku.
Super gross.
Trying to get this basement store with no sign that, and it's 100 people outside. Then you get to the front door and there's another 100 people inside.
Right.
And then you get in the store and it took like 2 hours to get the t-shirt I wanted and to check, like to buy it. And so the brand was a bathing ape.
Sure.
And like nobody at that point in the US knew what this brand was. And I just had to stumble upon it and, you know, bought it, got the shirt I wanted, and then went back to the magazine and kind of like asked for more information and got into it. And then the more I learned about it, the more I was like, oh, this is like a really cool brand. And so then when I got back to school, I started to tell, like, I did two things, like on the personal side. I was just like dying for any information about the brand. So I was spending all my time, like just like there was no Google at that point.
And so, so stay at that moment for a second. Like what was so compelling about it for you?
I think what was compelling about it was, yeah, I mean, I've skipped a whole big other part of this, which is as an American kid, especially from the South, fashion is not something that's like in my vocabulary.
Sure.
Right? It's like just...
where would you buy your clothes when you were a kid?
The Gap would be fancy. And
I didn't even actually, I didn't know what the Gap was until I was in high school.
That's unfair. My mom bought clothes for me, right? I mean, it's like my mom bought 90% of my clothes for me and she would go to the Polo Ralph Lauren outlet.
Okay.
Near our house.
Wow.
And so we, like,
that's fancy.
So we had like, you know, nice preppy clothing and then I was like into, you know, indie bands. And so I would wear the Polo pants with like a Dinosaur Jr. t-shirt on top of it. And Doc Martens, that was like my rebel. Like,
I love how Doc Martens have come back again.
Yeah.
Like a total full circle.
So in high school, I just like wore Doc Martens every day and these band t-shirts. And so I was trying to like kind of do my own thing. But I remember buying the Dinosaur Jr. t-shirt. I think it cost $25 and being like, did you know a t-shirt could cost $25?
That is pretty expensive.
And so just kind of, I guess now that's maybe like 40 or 50, but you know, at the time it seemed insane. And when I went to Japan, I realized like everyone was super well-dressed like in Tokyo. And it was like, where did this come from? So everyone is wearing like casual clothing that fits perfectly on their bodies. It wasn't like overly baggy. Dark jeans, like dark denim was very in that summer.
Well, because
not hit in America.
Well, because we were also coming out of like the Django fit, like the big giant pant stuff. Like everyone looks like a clown, like in the mid 90s, the grunge, everything's dirty. Like nothing fits you. You're 6 layers of shirts.
Right.
You're like,
It was not a great look. And it just looked really sloppy. And everyone in Japan looked really well dressed, even if they're wearing a t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers. They're wearing the right t-shirt, the right jeans, the right sneakers.
Yeah.
And so I started feeling a pressure, like, oh, I gotta dress better.
But while you were in Tokyo.
When I was in Tokyo, and what I liked about Bathing Ape and those brands is that they were like, all you have to have is the right t-shirt, the right pair of jeans, the right sneakers, and you're fashionable. It's like, I could do that. Where it's like, when you saw Come to Garcon or something, it's like, I don't know where to start with this. I would go to Come to Garcon in New York just to see what it was like. And it was all for artists, you know, it's like rich artists to wear. So that like, I was not invited. So anyway, so I felt a new pressure to dress up, and these brands would give me the ingredients for that relatively easy.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like I was into the music and I felt like it had an authentic connection to the music, which was the other, I think, for Americans, more or less, like how you would get into a fashion at all. Because if you were a punk, you'd wear punk fashion.
Sure.
So all that made sense. And then it just seemed like I had stumbled on something like a cult. And because there was, you know, 3 hours in line to buy t-shirts. Like, it was just insane. And then the other interesting thing is I had gone up.
And how much were the t-shirts then?
They were like 5,600 yen or something. But what I saw when I went up the street to Takeshitadori is there was all these little like resellers.
Yeah.
And they were reselling shirts from 2 years ago for like sanman, it's like 30,000 yen or whatever, right?
Sure.
And so that whole thing too, it's like t-shirts were going up in value.
Right.
And so like, this is now obvious, right? Like in a supreme world, everyone knows this stuff. But at the time it's like, what is this phenomenon?
Right.
So I liked it on a personal level. Like I liked the music, I liked the clothes. And then on a, like a sociological level, it was like, I found something very cool and I don't know how to explain it. And so when I went back to school, I was kind of like just telling professors about it. Like I just got back from Tokyo and this is what I saw. Like what is this thing going on? And by my junior year or so, one TA like was like, that's your thesis. It's like, you can't do a thesis on t-shirts. Come on. And he's like, no, you should do that as your thesis. And then every time I pitched it to a professor, they're like, that's great. Like, that's a great thesis.
Wow.
So I was all like, during the time I was like, I can't believe how supportive everybody is being. And the other interesting thing at the time was, and I just realized this because I reconnected with the other guy I did this with. When I was online looking for information about Bathing Ape, there was basically one person like who I found had posted something on something about it. And he was into it because Bathing Ape had done these records with a label called Moax. There was like a trip hop label in the US, in the UK. And he was coming from that angle. I was coming at it from the Japan angle. And we both were like, this brand's super cool, but there's no info. What do we do in 1999? We should make a website about it.
Sure.
So we made the unofficial Bathing Ape webpage before Bathing Ape had a webpage.
Right. They didn't have one in Japanese even.
They didn't have
nothing. No presence.
Like brands didn't have
web. Well, I mean, even today, I mean, like Uniqlo barely has a website.
But you know, it's like they own Uniqlo.com.
Right.
At this point, like nobody was like, we're Polo Ralph Lauren.
Right.
We must have a website.
Right.
So we made a website that was like, it was unofficial. It wasn't trying to be, you know, whatever. And but it's just funny looking back now that we were like, yeah, we should make a website for this brand that doesn't have one.
But that's an interesting memory because like that's what we did for everything. Like I'm for my favorite indie bands when I was a kid, I was making websites for them unofficially. And I was putting bootleg MP3s up. Like I'd go to their concerts, record stuff, and then put those MP3s up. And then I remember years later, one of the bands like contacted me, was like, hey, could you take that down? And I was like, oh, that's so cool. I got contacted.
The point is the internet is still small enough where you don't think the other side's seeing it.
Yeah.
It's like you're kind of off.
No one's seeing it. So did the Bape people ever?
No.
No, oh, of course not.
What happened was in 1999, the New York Times did an article about super rare street fashion. Okay. Like they had finally caught on
in 99.
In 99.
Wow.
And they were like, they had gotten tipped off that the brand that people were going crazy about was Bathing Ape.
Right.
Because all these art directors from New York were flying to the UK because there's only one store in the UK that sold it. And there's one store in the US that sold it like in some very small quantities. So you couldn't get it. I mean, that's the other part about this. It's like, this is really pre-globalization in the sense that Bathing Ape, you could only buy in Tokyo and they were not interested in exporting.
At one shop
in person. And there's one shop in London that was getting some. There's one shop in New York and they were both friends with Neo, the guy who ran the brand.
Yeah.
And the New York one, I would go there all the time and they just would... We wouldn't have it. The store was called Recon. They would have it probably like three times a year. They would just randomly get a box
of t-shirts,
and they would sell out. So the New York Times was running this article, right. And so they're looking for any information about Bathing Ape online. Of course, there's none except for our website.
Right.
So the writer writes me and is like, "Hey, can I interview you about Bathing Ape?" I was like, of course you can. And so then I gave this interview as if I'm like the PR spokesperson for Bathing Ape.
Well, did they think you were officially connected with the brand?
No, but I was just like, here's how it works. And so I'm quoted in this article and I was so proud.
And then
the Recon, the store that sold it, you know, wrote me and they're like, who do you think you are? Like, you're doing interviews on behalf of this brand that like has nothing to do with you. And so we had to kind of apologize to them. But my thesis when I turned it in, that was the intro. It's like this angry email.
Really?
You know, from the guy who actually sold it. So the other great part about that story is New York Times goes to the store and says, can we take a photo of the Bathing Ape shirt? And they're like, absolutely not. And then they said, can we buy a Bathing Ape shirt? And they said, nope, you can't buy one. So, you know, that just, you know, added to this idea that it was this weird cult that I had stumbled onto because right. people were getting angry at me for telling other people about it. And but I was just some dorky kid who shouldn't have, you know, like.
No, I think that's completely the wrong. It's not at all. I think they were the ones who, you know, had dropped the ball there. You know, and if they wanted...
they didn't want to. I mean, yeah. See, the other thing is, like, I met Nigo in 1998. And I asked Nigo, I was like, please sell your clothing in America. And he was like, why? You know, and someone explained to me later, like, America, people just see it as, like, mass. You know, it's just somewhere you sell 10,000s of things and they sell 100 shirts. Like, why would they sell it in America? So, like, I think there was still this idea that they weren't interested in selling in America.
Right.
And so I wrote my thesis. I went back in 2000 and I did more research. I went to the store. I went to as many stores as I could in Japan. Like I went to Nagoya and Kyoto and Osaka. I interviewed a bunch of people kind of around Nigo. I asked for an interview and he was just out of town or something. I don't think he was against being interviewed.
Sure.
But, and I talked to Tokion, the magazine that was founded by two American guys in Japan. And they had worked with Bathing Ape a lot. And
how were they connected with them? I think
that they just were all kind of in the same scene. And they started in 93 and Bathing Ape started in 93.
What was that scene? Just kind of like pop culture?
Yeah, just like street fashion, street art, slightly indie underground 90s stuff. But they put Nigo on the cover in like 96 or something. Definitely the first time he'd probably been on a magazine cover.
Sure.
So they were connected with Bathing Ape and I interviewed them. And went home and wrote a thesis about kind of why the marketing works and kind of sensed that there had been a history of fashion in Japan and trying to figure that out. But so I turned in my thesis in 2001 and, you know, my thesis gets something completely wrong, which is the end of it. I'm like, Bathing Ape is the most underground thing ever and it will never sell out. They would probably close the brand before they ever sold out.
That's how you ended it.
Yeah. And then 2002, somebody sends me this like link to Bape Pepsi, like the word Bape and Pepsi together. And I was like, this is a joke. I mean, they wouldn't do a campaign with Pepsi. They had done this giant campaign with Pepsi. And in hindsight, like they had really started pivoting towards being a mass market brand in Japan. And then it went like, you know, insanely that direction. And then finally 2003-ish, Pharrell from the Neptunes met up with Nigo.
Right.
And he was really impressed and went back to America and basically helped bring Bathing Ape to America. And then by 2003, it became the hottest hip hop brand,
right?
You know, in the world. And so, you know, there was this very weird thing where I had turned in the thesis thinking it was one thing. And then 2 years later, it had become a completely different thing.
Right. Well, that's okay.
Yeah. So it's like, people are like, can I read your thesis? It's like, it's describing a very, very specific point in time. And it's not the whole story.
So, I mean, that basically sets up why you would write the book on Aitora.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like an extent. It's just the fuller story of kind of all that, going back a little further, going forward a little further.
Yeah. I mean, I think what doing that research got me into is one of my main research tools was to go through magazines. And what I wanted to see is like, why did Bathing Ape get big? And so if you could go through magazines every month and see kind of where it shows up,
kind of reverse engineering.
Yeah, you can kind of look like, oh, here's where it gets the big feature and all that. So I was doing all that work and spent most of my research. I would just like get a stack of like every hot dog press from 1993 and go through every single one and photocopy every single article and then go read it back in the US. And as I was doing that, I realized those Japanese magazines love to do something, which is like the timeline of like, here's 1981, here's 1982. And what I noticed about it was that every year had its own like micro trend.
Yeah.
And like 80 was American ivy. 81 was British ivy. 82 was French ivy, you know, or whatever it was. And I thought that was a very Japanese kind of phenomenon. But I realized there was kind of a deep history of changes and styles. And I was fascinated to kind of find out more. And then I had spent, I think when I first got here, then I came in 2003 to get a master's degree in consumer behavior and marketing, because the consumer behavior was trying to figure out, I wanted to figure out that kind of old mystery, which was, why does everybody all like the same stuff at the same time?
Right.
And I'm not sure that at the end of the day, that's a consumer behavior question. That's actually the weird thing about consumer behavior as a field, is that I found that it was very much about the individual trying to figure out how the individual makes purchase decisions, which is more or less impossible to understand. And I was much more interested in, why do a group of people all at the same time do the same thing? And that's more a sociology question.
I mean, it feels like a media issue. Well, fundamentally, right?
And then in the case of Japan, yeah, it's like 100% tied to how do people consume information, and then how do they act upon it? And so my, you know, whether it's writing Amatora or the academic work I've done or the book I'm writing now, is very much about information and media. You can't take that piece out of any kind of fashion research you do. So I was interested in more or less the history of Japanese fashion as a thing. And then because my master's thesis needed data, I switched over to looking at pop music, because you could use the pop charts to also look at popularity. It was I don't really like surveying people. Like, how do you feel about something and then doing data on it? Because everyone lies.
Sure.
And there's actually a good book about this, I think, that's called Everybody Lies, about just how no one ever tells you the truth about their own like tastes.
Right.
And so I really don't like looking at using people's survey results in order to do research. So I was like, how can I look at output, which is like their action? And I think music charts were better at saying if they like this artist, they're going to buy their record. I don't need them to tell me they like the artist. So I ended up doing stuff about music and then putting away the fashion stuff for a while. And then around the 2006 or seven or so, I got back into the fashion stuff, actually, because I was looking at women's fashion. Because this magazine Can-Can was super duper popular, and I was just interested in where did this come from? So I got way back into fashion magazines and trying to figure them out. And from there, I at that point actually worked with my current agent. I was trying to make a book just about the history of Japanese fashion. So I wrote a proposal and all that, and it just kind of faded out for some reason I don't understand.
Yeah. So it feels like the seeds of Ametora were college, essentially. I mean, that's kind of when the interest in sociological components of fashion and what was happening in trends and stuff here. And then when did the start of the thing that became the manuscript that was published, when did that really begin in earnest? Was that 2010, 2011?
Yeah. So what the very specific thing that happened was, there is a book, a Japanese photo book called Take Ivy.
Yep.
And Take Ivy was made in 1965. And it was a Japanese film crew and a photographer went to the Ivy League campuses just to photograph daily life. And I had seen it in Japan. If you ever went to one of the stores for one of these brands, they would always have it in their bookshelf. And so I was aware of that it was kind of a cult item.
Yeah.
And then I saw an article about how copies of it were in the US were going for $300.
How many were produced, do you think? How many
originally?
The print run?
I mean, I think the original print run in 65 was 5,000 or something.
Okay.
It was very expensive at the time. I mean, 65, nobody is buying clothes or much of anything. It's still pretty poor.
Sure.
And 2,500 of them went to the stores that sold. So there's a brand called Van Jacket that kind of produced it. And 2,500 of the copies went to Van Jacket retailers.
Yep.
And 25 were sold on the open market. And there's not that many of them. It was reprinted in 73 and then 80. And so those copies are the ones you find. But anyway, so people in the U.S. were obsessed with it, and then Powerhouse Books in Brooklyn decided to do an English edition.
Right.
And as that was being prepared, I was kind of writing about the original, and I went to this place called Brif Osh, which is a Shoeshine Bar.
That was that's actually, I found that guy. Talk about web presence being important. Yeah. I was living around the corner from it for years. I lived around the corner from that guy for probably like for 10 years. And I needed to get my shoes shined. I had one pair of like shoes that could shine shoes. And I literally searched for like Kutsumigaki Omotesando. And he just had really good SEO. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, this place is like a 5-minute walk from my tiny little, I was living in this like little tatami mat apartment. And I went over there and I was like, who is this guy? This is like the fanciest, dandiest like shoe shiner man ever. And that was probably 2007.
Okay.
I think like really early. Like he had just kind of opened
it. Wasn't that expensive at that point. It's now pretty insane.
There's no day in my life now that I'd ever imagine going to Briftage to get.
But you know, for people who have not been there, you walk in and you would get this flute of like apple juice, of like sparkling apple juice, and then they would in front of you.
Well, and it's like this dark, it's velvety. Yeah. It looks like you're in like a vampire.
It's like a bar. It's like a
vampire
it's like
bar.
A cigar bar where they polish your shoes. So I was in there doing that for an article and for CNN, because I was working at CNN at the time. As I'm sitting there enjoying my flute of sparkling apple juice. This guy walks in, I guess to get some boots polished, and he's like, look at this, I got a copy of Take Ivy, and all four authors have signed it, and it's got a printing error, like how rare this is. And I was like, wow, I just wrote an article about that, that's super cool. And then he was like, oh, I used to work at Van Jacket. I was like, oh, that's very cool. And then he said, oh, I know the founder's son, I'll introduce you to him. And then he got on the phone, he's like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And then so he's like, you're meeting him next week. And so I went to go meet the founder's son. So the founder is Kinsuke Ishizu, and then the son is Shosuke Ishizu. So I went to the Ishizu office and got to meet Shosuke Ishizu and asked him about making Take Ivy and just like asked him about, you know, the old days and just realized, oh, the people that did this stuff are all alive, but they're in their late 70s. And it's a really interesting story. And, you know, the U.S. seems to be obsessed, or at least this very small menswear community is obsessed with American fashion, but in Japan and the Japanese brands, but they don't know any of the backstory about like, why were they doing any of this? They're just writing like, yeah, of course people in 1965 went to America to shoot Ivy League campuses.
Sure, sure.
So I thought what could be cool is like a book that was a backstory.
Yeah.
And so Take Ivy, the English edition, ended up selling about 50,000 copies at the time. I think it's more now, which is very good.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's
and
crazy.
So
wow.
When I saw that, it was like, oh, so I actually pitched
Powerhouse
on, let me do a companion edition that's like Taking Ivy. It's a story of like how Take Ivy got made. And they actually suggested, you know, people are obsessed with Japanese denim too. Why don't you just do a whole book about the history of American fashion in Japan, like the whole thing? And I thought, oh, I have the streetwear stuff and I don't know the jean stuff actually that well, but I'll figure it out. And then this part, I can do that. Like the whole thing connects. And so they were like, great.
This is what year is this again?
This is now 2013.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And I'm remembering a lot of this like in real time here because I like buried a lot of it. But so they said, I was like, great, like send me a contract. They're like, just go ahead and write it. And so I wrote it on spec basically, and the entire book.
That's a good move.
I wrote it. And then my agent at the time, I pitched her maybe like 6 months before I talked to Powerhouse and said, hey, I'm going to do this book. She's like, so interesting, super niche. I don't have time for this. But if you have a contract, I will read it for you. So I wrote the whole book very quickly in about 12 months. And I was just like, 16 months. And I had done a lot of pre-reading on the Ivy stuff. So I knew that. And when I say reading, it's like Japanese source material, right? And so there's books about this stuff. At some point I realized that every chapter or every like kind of genre, so it goes through Ivy League fashion, jeans, heavy duty, which is this kind of outdoor style.
Yeah.
Yankee fashion, which is like kind of rock and roller stuff. Preppy and designer brands, streetwear, vintage, and then kind of it was a chapter about now. And I realized there was kind of a character who actually you could follow that would tell the whole story because there was actually usually one person who made it happen.
Right.
And so very early, I decided to write the book in a very narrative form, which is I'll follow one person for a chapter and kind of tell the whole thing from that. And, you know, Lawrence Wright, I think is, I remember reading Going Clear, which is the Lawrence Wright book about Scientology, around then. And I was like, I want to write a book like this, in the sense that it's so compelling. It's nonfiction, but you just tear through it because he's just telling stories, you know. And I don't know whether I had subconsciously or consciously got that idea from him, but most certainly it's like, that's his technique that I borrowed. And so I decided to tell the story through the people. And that really helped, because then I could just go read a ton of interviews with them and, you know, figure out what they were thinking, interview them myself if they were alive and it was possible. So I spent about, you know, 14 to 16 months interviewing everybody, going to the National Diet Library all the time, pulling out all the old magazines, photocopying, going back home, reading all of them.
And what was like, how did you motivate yourself? This is, sounds like an insane amount of work, and you don't have a real contract. Your agent is sort of, I'm not interested in this one. What was the engine here? Where was that fire coming from?
I mean, we're like jumping around, like, you know, you're not getting my whole history, but, you know, I wrote a blog.
Sure.
And I wrote a website for a long time with no advertising.
Sure.
No money.
So you,
and the idea was just get ideas out there.
Right.
And if there's like stories need to be told, just tell them.
So even like, okay, so then going back to like the blog, like the blog is called Neo-Japanism.
Yeah.
And like what was driving that? I mean, was it just to get these ideas out there and to spark conversations? And were you trying to connect with people? Were you lonely? I mean,
it's just the, you know, I don't know. It's like, I don't know if it's zine mentality.
Right,
like,
right, right.
You know, you make stuff, you say it, you get it to people who care.
I mean, there's something punk rock about just being like, I'm just going to do crazy research on esoteric stuff and put it out there.
Yeah. And just because it's like, I think people are interested in this and I hope they read it and that's great. I mean, I don't know. I mean, now thinking back, it's scary almost, because if I think now, my logic now, I probably wouldn't have written that book.
Well, and like I was saying, I reread it last weekend and I kind of read it in 2 days and just kind of lived in that world. And you really are struck by how this like shouldn't exist. This is a book that you're just, this is so geeky and so weird and niche, and like, who would think until it was done, until you read it, who would ever think that this is a story people would want out there or want to read, right? I mean, I understand why your agent was like, that sounds great, have fun. You know, it's like, you've got to.
And when I heard that, I wasn't like, oh no, I should make a different book. I was like, okay.
I've already written 400,000 words on my blog that I haven't gotten a penny for.
I don't know. It's funny thinking back now, because it just made perfect sense that I would go write this book, and I didn't think twice.
But I do think that impulse is critical. And I think that people who are like, oh, I've got to wait for the perfect moment to do this thing, or I have to have all of the ducks in a perfect row before I start. Like, you just felt this unsuppressible impulse to do this thing, and you just had to write this book. And that's like, I feel like that's probably the best place from which to write a book. No. You know, it's like the only way to get through it.
The other thing is, like, I would see on Twitter some journalists be like, oh my God, why did I agree to write the book that I did? I'm so miserable. Right. Don't ever write books, people. And I was like, I'm having a good time of my life. Because I would go to the library and I would pull something. I would find some new fact. They'd be like, when people read this, it's going to blow their mind. So I was really excited about what I was finding, about how the story was coming together. I had this, you know, and every time I write anything, I just have this nagging devil on my shoulder being like, you know, everyone knows this. You know, you're like the last person to find this out.
Well, I was going to say, like, is there not a Japanese equivalent of this book that you could have just like translated? No. It just doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist, because each piece there are books about.
Right.
And that helped a lot, except for the vintage section. Actually, there wasn't one book. And in the Harajuku stuff, like I wrote in the sense of like my streetwear stuff from college was like actually some of the most detailed stuff. But there are books, and there are a lot of magazine articles and all that. And the other thing that was amazing is Men's Club, the men's fashion magazine that I mostly reference in the book. They would do every week these taidan, like they would put four of the guys in a room and just like talk about what's up. And so you knew it, like August 1966, this is exactly what they're thinking.
Right.
Because you would hear, you would have that whole dialogue.
Sure.
Which is, you just don't have that in any other publication. It's a very Japanese thing. Because I mean, I think it's just to fill pages. But
Sure. Having four people just talk is a good way to fill up a magazine. Well, to fill up a magazine if you're just...
But also to know what they were thinking. And so that was super helpful. And, you know, there was something I got where no one knew how to pronounce Nike, right? And so they were calling it Nike or whatever. And I think somebody told me, like, that's not true, but it's like, I've got it right here in this, right, like, thing where people were like, I thought it was called Nike, or, you know, or someone called it Nike or whatever. So,
or Nike.
So, you know, there wasn't one book because no one, and this is what someone told me later of why the book is popular with Japanese audiences, is nobody in Japan saw this as a one linear narrative.
Sure,
they
sure.
saw it as like, well, that's eight different things.
Right.
And what I was trying to show is like, they're all super connected and right. they can be connected literally, even if Ivy fashion is established as a competitor, jeans is established as a competitor,
sure.
you know, whatever is established, but you know, things react against each other.
Right.
And that is the same narrative, even if there are reactions against each other. And then, you know, the Harajuku stuff people also think is like a different vector, but I was showing that like it kind of echoes all these other things, and it's reacting against the infrastructure that was set
yeah.
by these brands in the 70s and 80s. So that I think that was unique, which is that no one in Japan had thought to put it all together into one book.
Also, I want to just bring up another thing about like this moment in time in your life when you're writing this, because I think it's like very easy for people out there listening or whatever to be like, oh, David was single and he was just alone and he was just a freelancer and he had no job and he was just able to do that, you know, work on this book full time and your trust fund paid for it or something. But like you had an actual extremely full-time serious job at a big company.
Yeah.
And you were doing that while you were writing this book and you have a family.
Yeah.
You had two kids were born by that point. So it's like you have two kids. You have two kids. They were young, but you had a full-time job and you'd be commuting on the train, writing chapters on your phone, right?
Well, I would read on the train, but you know, I would wake up every morning and write for at least an hour.
Okay.
And then on the weekends, I would get like a good 4 hours probably in the morning before anybody was like, where's dad to like take care of me? So I, you know, the 1 hour a day trick is this thing like you'll hear on every like self-help sure. thing as it, and you're like, whatever, you can't do that. It totally works.
That's
like
it.
If you do 16 months and you do an 1 hour a day, you will write a book.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I was using my time wisely and that was the thing I was passionate about. And I mean, I have some other hobbies, but it's not like that's my hobby, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was busy, but I loved all the work on that. And if I got to go home and, you know, read some articles and put some notes in, I'll outline. And the other thing too, is I think with nonfiction, what, you know, I work on outlines. And so I'll, you know, say, okay, here's the chapter about this. It's going to have four sections. Okay. Each section is these are the eight things that need to be in there. Then I have, you know, in the outline, one for every paragraph, I have a entry.
Okay.
And then when I get a piece of information, I slide it into with the like reference.
Yep.
And then as I put it in the thing, I put it into the notes. And it's like, so I have this whole system. And what it also means that if I'm down to paragraph three in section four and I got to go, like I get ready for the day, then I just come back to it. I know exactly where I am.
Right.
And so that, I think it was easy to write nonfiction that way. I don't know if I would be able to write a fiction book
sure.
where it's just like, I just do it in 30-minute increments.
Right, right, right.
So I think there's something about nonfiction and the way, especially history too, is linear. And, you know, I still write like that now, like it's very, very formal.
And you and mainly in Google Docs?
Yeah.
You're like a full Google Docs writer.
Yeah.
That's your tool.
Yeah. And it's like everything's linking to each other. And
what do you mean everything's linking to each other?
So just like, you know, I have a doc that's like the table of contents doc and I open it and it's like all of those link to the chapter.
Okay.
And then, you know, each chapter has a section in its own doc and then they all come together. And
I see.
So, you know, that does make it easier if you're someone who's not a full-time 8-hour.
Yeah.
Day writer kind of person.
So you write this thing in sort of like a spurt of manic
yeah.
like sort of joy
or yeah.
like your family job and this thing is somehow getting written. It gets finished. It's all in Google Docs. Your agent isn't repping you for it.
Well, she said one very important thing.
What was that?
She said, if you get a contract, I'll look over it.
Okay. Powerhouse
is like, my understanding, they're like, here's what the cover would look like. Here's the title. Blah, blah, blah. And so
that's what they're saying.
They're like, they're that far. And I'm like, great. Where's the contract? And they're like, yeah. So I get the contract and then I'm like, I got the contract. I send it to my agent and she's like, please do not sign this.
Oh no.
So she's like, what are you doing? And it's like, I don't know. And then she, I think, realized at that point, it's like, you wrote a book and I'm reading it and it's way more like appealing than I thought it was going to be. So why don't I just send it to some editors? Like, and so she sent it to a bunch of editors, and I got a lot of polite rejections. Like, that's really interesting. Good luck.
Well, how many rejections did she get? Did you,
I think she probably sent it to 10 editors, and I got 9 rejections.
Okay.
And then the one editor at Basic Books, which is part of Perseus and now part of Hachette, they were building out a men's fashion, like a smart men's fashion collection, in the sense that, like, Basic Books is a publisher for academics to write books for the public. Okay. That's like the point of it.
Sure.
So it's like, if you look back who's written books for Basic Books, it's like, I think Einstein has one or something. It's like really, really like just like top academic people.
It's quite old.
Yeah. I mean, I always like buy really interesting books, and it's like, oh, that's a Basic book from the 50s right. or something. So
they were into it.
They were into it because they just published a book called True Style by Bruce Boyer, who's like a menswear historian.
Okay.
And they wanted to build out a men's fashion, smart men's fashion books thing. And so the editor was like, we want to do this. They like sent my manuscript to two experts, like an actual fashion scholar, to be like, is this legit? And then they came back like, yeah, it's good. So they signed it, and that editor then quit like weeks later, which I think is a common story in publishing.
Right.
And then an editorial assistant took it over, and that person quit.
Right.
And then I think the intern was like the person left to like edit it at the end. And so, you know, I didn't go with Powerhouse, and I went with this other publisher.
Basic.
Yeah. And with Basic. And so, yeah, it came out. Then I just like did, you know, revisions over the year. Oh, the main thing is that I turned it in, it was about 110,000 words.
Okay.
And they were like, it's got to be 70. And it's like, great, let's compromise. Like 90. They're like, oh, it's got to be 70. I'm like, okay, so let's do plus 10%. So that's like 77. They're like, it's got to be 70. And so I went on summer vacation, and I didn't have internet connection, and I would have to tether from my phone. And so I would just like go and do offline Chromebook editing.
Right.
And then like, once I was going to save it, I would like tether unsave
that's
it.
That's daring.
Wow. But I did a whole week where I just, before they could tear it apart, I was like, I will tear it apart.
Sure.
And so I just removed every single time there was like two sentences and they said the same thing. I'd often have a quote from somebody and then I would say the same thing, like, sure, to summarize it. And so I just got rid of every like piece I, sure, could of the fat, and ended up turning in a 72,000 word thing or whatever.
What a great exercise to be forced to.
Wow. I cannot remember anything. Right. I mean, it's such a, at the time you're like, I can't.
This is the 40,000
words out of here.
Yeah.
And then you're like, what was in there?
What was their obsession with that word count? Why were they so?
I don't know, but they were right. I mean, it is a great 70,000.
Should they have
book.
Said 60?
No. I think my joke at that point is they took out a ruler. Yeah. And they're like, the book should be this thick.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I think they're totally right. It was a 70,000 word book.
Yeah.
So so I did all that, and it seemed very painful, but it wasn't.
Right.
At the end of it, it was like, that was a good exercise. Yeah. And what happened after that? So then it came out in December 2015.
Okay.
And, you know, everyone around me was like, why would you do this?
Is that thing still recording?
That's what I'm making sure. I think it will be. But so everyone was like, why would you do such a niche book?
It's still going?
Yeah.
All right. Good.
And the publicity department of Basic was incredible. And so they were getting it everywhere. So it's like New York Times, Wall Street Journal, like all those people were reviewing it. And then it was in People magazine, which is just insane. Like it was a very slow month for books. I guess December is actually not a good time to release your book,
right,
because you can't get on any.
Well, no one can buy it for Christmas. And yeah.
So it was in People magazine. So the press was really good. The main thing is, like, I wrote this book for a bunch of men's fashion bloggers.
Right.
And I sent it. You got sent to all of them, and it was just like silence. So no one was like,
"Why? Why do you think? Why?"
I don't know.
What was going on?
So no one was like, "I hate it. This is stupid." But also, no one was like, "I like it," or no one was like, "This book exists." It was like literally like we were going to pretend like this book never happened.
Wow.
And so I, you know, like a couple of, like, put this on as a great menswear blog, they covered it. So like there was definitely some people who were covering it, but there's a lot of people who didn't. And then, you know, it was very strange because at first it did feel very quiet. The first 6 months, the reviews were great. The press was very good, but like it didn't seem to be a ton of sales, but like it kind of was very quiet. And then, I think it had gotten, it's people in the US. Oh, sorry. This is really one of the first big things, is people in Japan started to notice the US press about it.
Okay.
So we tried to sell the book really early to Japanese publishers and they were totally disinterested.
Right.
And then they saw the press in the US and suddenly they were like, then it was like, ooh, now there's a lot of bids. So it went to auction in Japan.
Okay.
And DU Books, Disc Union Books got the rights.
Yeah.
And they're a super duper cool publisher. Like they're Indian small, but they own all the disc unions and every disc union has a book section.
Yeah.
And they're really good about getting their books into Staya. They have like very, very good distribution network.
But also to back up for a second, like the Japanese edition, was that on your mind when you were writing it?
No, not at all.
Right.
I mean, this is the other thing. It's like, you know, you were saying, why did you write this book? It's like, I'm glad I wasn't thinking about it.
Right.
But you know, I didn't think at all that this book would ever come out in Japan.
Right.
Which makes no sense. I don't know why.
But it also complicates things, right? Because it's like you're quoting primary sources. And like,
so you've what got I was doing is quoting Japanese sources, doing my own English translation, yeah, and then not remembering where the Japanese was.
Yeah.
Like I was like, put this later because, you know, you're going to need it. And so I signed the rights for the Japanese one. And the translator comes on, Yuji Okada. He had done Julian Cope's Japrock sampler and he used to be a magazine editor and she's like a great partner in this. And we met and I was like, I will help you with this. So I'll prepare the text, which means I will go through the English. I will highlight all of the proper nouns and go ahead and put in the Japanese that I know it is. So you don't have to look it up. And then every quote, I will try to find the original for you.
Right.
So you're not back translating my translation.
Right.
And that took forever.
Yeah.
I mean, it took months for me to go through all my materials.
Well, because the appendix in the back is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like reference works in the back of that book. It's a massive list of.
Yeah.
Like you did. This is what I mean by like, it feels like a miracle book in the sense of like, the amount of research, the amount of care, the amount of like you weren't just like, oh, I'll summarize this stuff and not give them credit or whatever. You're like, I'm going to give credit for every single millimeter of information I get from other sources. And to then, have to go back because then if the original source reads it, which is highly likely.
Well, I didn't think about that. I just thought about like, it is duty. It should be the original Japanese.
Because I've had articles that I've done where I've interviewed Japanese people. I've done my own translations. I haven't kind of done in real time as I'm interviewing them. You know, I'll be taking notes or whatever and putting it into English. And then those articles, I had one where like they didn't ask me and then they retranslated it.
Yeah.
And like the only reason that a lot of these Japanese people agreed to talk to me was because they knew it was not going to be in Japanese. They're like, it's only for the foreign market. Like, oh, I can say these things. I can be more open because I know that this isn't going to come out and the people that I'm talking about aren't going to see this because they can't read English or whatever. And so I've had to have people pull translations down like that have been commissioned without my approval.
Right. I cleared a lot of my quotes. When I'd interviewed people and I used the Japanese and then did it in English, I went back to them and said, look, this is the Japanese. It's going to
be used.
Okay?
Is that
okay? And everyone was cool with it.
Yeah.
But that was a big process. And again, I've totally forgotten about it. That was my 2016 was just spent
doing that,
prepping the Japanese, which I didn't even translate. Right. So the other thing was Popeye licensed the book where they would do a chapter. We would summarize. You can't do a full chapter on one page, but we would summarize one chapter per page. Per issue for about 12 issues or whatever it was. And so the process was that we were going to take a whole year to translate it, which was actually quite nice. And so I would prep the text. I would prep the text in the sense of like, I would say, just do this for the Popeye column. And then I would send it to the translator. He would send it back. I would read through it. And then, you know, we would do one. And then, okay, next one. So it was, we had time to do it, but it just stretched the whole thing out. And then when they finished the whole thing, I had to go sit down and I actually did a side-by-side read for the entire book.
Yeah.
So I'd read the English paragraph, say, what am I saying? And I'd read the Japanese and say, is that the same sense? And the main thing, and there was only like a couple errors I fixed, but the main thing was just that when I said something that was like the smallest hint of negative like critical or something in English, it would, the Japanese read like I was like yelling at somebody. Just because Japanese is such not as much of a critical language. Sure. And so I think like I said that, you know, this Junya Watanabe is hired to desecrate a brand. And desecrate, I mean, in English, maybe like it doesn't sound great, but it was kind of in the context means like just to mess it up.
Sure.
But the whatever the translation was just like to stomp on, you know, like something that was so dark. And I was like, I'm not going that far.
Right.
And so the main thing I did was tone down
the
Japanese rather than like fix errors.
And so, I mean, this is you.
Oh, yeah, sorry. There's one other thing, which is I got some stuff wrong.
Oh.
And, like in the sense that like I got facts wrong. And the main one was this brand Van Jacket. At the time, it was seen that they were making blazers, and blazers weren't a thing that was sold. And then the Olympic uniform in 64 was a red blazer and white pants. And then from there, blazers became really popular. And the designer, Kensuke Ishizu, or the guy from Van Jacket, was on the Olympic uniform committee. So people had put two and two together to say he must have come up with the red blazer. And actually, there was articles that were saying that and like quoting people at the time saying he came up with it.
And so you went with that.
So I went with that because that was all the information he had. So then this woman researcher came out. She's a scholar at, I forget, Oshinomizu University or whatever. She talked to the original tailor. I was like, no, that guy came up with it. So she came up with a whole book that's like, actually, that's all wrong. And it was very awkward. And like, I was trying to figure it out at the time. And because I was like, I'm really surprised because why is somebody doing this Ivy League looking blazer without knowing it? And what I didn't know until I kind of saw it was that all the Olympics uniforms over time had always kind of looked after blazers in the sense of British sporting jackets.
Sure.
So there was a tradition of that. And like, anyway, I messed it up. So in the Japanese one, I was able to fix it and kind of get the right information, but the English one still has the old
Right. But so you've spent like years and years and thousands of hours of work on this thing. And even like the Japanese edition, like you've gone so above and beyond what any other author would ever do if their work was being published in Japanese. I mean, mainly because most other authors couldn't read it.
Yeah, I mean, if for authors who are Japanese readers, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they would.
But this feels... And I mean, and so in the end, like financially, totally worth it, right? I mean, do you feel like
you're... I mean, is that it? the Japanese comes out, and it does really well.
Better than the English...
No, well, it's just the numbers are numbers, but like, so we're on the seventh printing of the Japanese
book, sure,
which is a surprise.
Right.
I mean, I certainly didn't think it would get that. There's a Taiwanese edition in traditional Chinese. There's a Chinese edition, which is called Harajuku Cowboys.
Nice.
And they were like, what do you think of that title? I was like, is that my book? Like, did I write Harajuku Cowboys? And they're like, it's definitely going to sell. And they were right.
Really?
Publishers are often right.
What market in the end has been best selling?
And then the Korean edition just came out.
Right.
So there's the five. And it's interesting also because they've used, like, I think the Taiwanese edition used the Japanese edition.
Right, sure.
Not just the English and all sorts of things. So the great irony is that the simplified Chinese version has sold the most copies.
Yeah.
So it's on its third printing. It's just because the numbers are so big.
Right.
And books are really cheap in China.
Okay.
So I think it sells for like $5 US or something.
Really?
Okay. People bought it. I mean, street fashion is very big there. So they're buying it. That's why it's called Harajuku Cowboys. Because like denim and streetwear is big.
Right.
And the Ivy League stuff isn't. And so they kind of tweaked it to be more about that.
Yeah. That's great though. But I mean, like what a process for the whole thing. I mean, in the end, looking back, it was how many years? So 2013 is kind of when you started in earnest writing it.
Yeah.
2013, 2014, comes out 2015, which is actually pretty quick considering the amount of work that you had to do to get this thing done. Comes out in end of 2015, late 2015. And then the Japanese rights are sold pretty quickly after that, 6 months after that. You spend a year.
And I think the Japanese comes out in 2017, so did take a bit. And that mostly was because they slow walked it with the Popeye.
Okay.
The other thing is like the Popeye serialization, I was like so proud.
Yeah. Popeye. You're in Popeye.
I never saw anyone reference that. And so I never got a sense that anyone was reading it. So that worried me too. And the book came out that then you finally started getting response.
Right. And so then that's 2017, like late 2017.
Yeah.
So that's,
and at that point, it's like, I'm trying to write another book by that point.
Right. You know, right. Time. Right. And so now how do you see, this kind of like post publishing of Ame Tora, like in the US and in Japan, like how much of your time is spent kind of responding to that? What percentage of these markets are reaching out to you to be like, hey, we want to talk to you. We want you to come on our show. We want you to blah, blah, blah.
What? Yeah, it's like a long seller. So do you say that in English? I mean, I know you say that in Japanese.
Long seller. But, yeah.
It's spread by word of mouth.
Sure.
And the other thing is, you know, as I said at the beginning, the Americans kind of ignored it. I wrote the book thinking it's about America and Japan, and therefore it's for Americans and Japanese people.
Right, right.
And the biggest audience at first seemed to be the UK.
Okay.
And it's just, there's more guys into fashion in the UK.
Sure.
So the UK response was really good. As okay. Menswear stores were all stocking it, and you started to see that movement. I think that's the other thing, is that it wasn't bookstores. Because like bookstores in the US, I would go to like Green Apple Books in San Francisco, which I love. And downstairs they would have the spread of all the new books, and the like basic books had like four or five titles there, and mine would not be there.
Right.
So I couldn't find my book anywhere other than like Kinokuniya. And if you think about it, it's like, where do you put it? Like some bookstores have a fashion section, but most don't.
Right.
And even in the fashion section, it's pretty buried because fashion books are generally art books.
Right.
There's not a lot of like a narrative of fashion type right. thing. So I never saw it on sale in the US, which always disappointed me.
Was there, I mean, what, do you think there's a way looking back that it could have been reframed slightly to better fit the market? I mean, I don't mean to like how do you calculate?
Well,
how do
I mean, coldly so calculate like the title, this? You know, you were saying, would you have called it Ame Tora?
Yeah.
Earlier, you said, would you call it Ame Tora? And when I turned it in as Ame Tora, Cultural History of American Fashion in Japan.
Okay.
And they're like,
too much.
You can't call it Ame Tora.
Oh.
No one knows what Ame Tora is. Right. And Ame Tora, by the way, means American traditional.
Sure.
It also means American truck. And so right, if you search Ame Tora right. in Japanese, there's a game called American Truck Simulator. Right. So you get a lot of like screen grabs of like people driving a big truck through the middle of like Idaho
Saitama?
Or whatever.
Oh, Idaho, it's American.
It's American Truck Simulator. Oh. And so what happened? So anyway, so they said, go think of another title. So I spent like 3 months trying to think what the other title would be. And what I came up with was, everyone in the book was talking about trying to recreate the real thing, which is homono.
Yep.
And so I was like, okay, the real thing, that could be a good title for the book.
Right. That's cool.
So
History of Coca-Cola.
Like the real thing, History of Coca-Cola. And they came back to me. They're like, we've got the perfect title for you. I was like, oh, great. What is it? They're like, Ame Tora.
Really?
Yeah. And it was Ame Tora. How Japan Conquered American Fashion. And I was like, okay, first of all, you just published a book called Star Wars, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. So I know why you're using the word conquered. It's because you just used the word conquered. It's like that bad writer thing where you've just used a word and you think, aha.
It's a good word.
Sustainable.
Yes.
I'm going to use that. And you're like, oh, that's, I know it because it's from two sentences ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had How Conquered. I was like, Japan didn't conquer American style. It's not like everyone's wearing like American fashion on streets.
Right.
It's like a very niche.
Well, it would indicate like everyone in America is wearing kimonos now.
Yeah, right? It's not true. Like, I don't want to, it's a little hyperbolic. So then I said, in some sort of actual inspiration from somewhere, I said, okay, how Japan saved American style. And what I liked about it is that two meanings.
Yes.
Is that Japan saved it, as in it preserved it,
yep.
Or it archived it,
sure.
Which is like the story is that Japan archived yeah. the style that died in the United States, and it saved it in terms of rescued.
Yep.
And so it saved has both meanings as archived and rescued. What a great, like, meaningful title. And they're like, yeah, whatever, okay. So it became Ame Tora, How Japan Saved American Style. And which I was very comfortable with. And, but you know, like they saw it better. I don't know. The other problem is like, I think Hachette was in the process of buying Perseus. And so like, who owned my stock? Like, where was the book stock? Who could do it? I mean, all of that was up in the air. And right. so the other thing I was trying to do was like get somebody to pay attention to Japanese books, airport bookstores.
Right.
Because you go in, it's all American English books about Japan. It's right. like, can my book be here, please? And right. like, I could not get anyone to right. to figure that out. And then when Hachette like plugged in, like the Asia people were like, you like, you have a book about Japan. You're in Japan. That's awesome. Like, so they were really, really helpful. And I've had a great relationship with them. So, so could the book be sold better? Yes. I don't know. You know, it could be, but I think it was a hard place to be in indie bookstores.
Yeah.
But then really it was word of mouth that there's like some people read it and told people about it. Right. And from there it kind of spread. And then, you know, a lot of those people who are ignoring the book started admitting the book existed, but it took like 2 years
right.
or something. I think they were looking around saying,
well, I mean, I don't mean to like keep hammering on the title, which is a good title. Once you know the book, like once you read the book, it's like, oh, this makes sense. I understand it. And like, okay, yeah, that's a thing. But I do think it is a word that evokes nothing, right? Because I think this is kind of important. And probably like Harajuku Cowboy, I could see why the book has sold so well in China. I mean, aside from the fact there's a lot of Chinese people and books are cheap, and yeah, but like Harajuku Cowboy, like immediately you've got this like image of something, whereas like if someone says, hey, new book Ame Tora, and you're just like, whew, like there's nothing to grab onto. It's like an ice wall.
Let me reverse pitch you on that, which is I coined a word.
You did coin a word.
And I'm also proud of that, which is I've seen the word Ame Tora used in the New York Times with no reference to my book. Just like,
so how do they use brand, it?
Because now they're using it to mean, and again, it's like the semantics have changed, which is in Japanese, Ame Tora means very specifically American traditional style, as in mostly Ivy League clothing or a fisherman sweater,
right.
like just traditional things that American old money used to wear, more right. or less. In the US and in English, it now means American clothing that is made by Japanese brands.
Okay.
Like reproduction
interesting
clothing.
Yeah.
And so when the New York Times talks about brands like that, they'll be like, they're Ame Tora.
Yeah.
And just as a noun.
That's interesting.
It's not like David Marks's book, but just like Ame Tora, of course,
right,
that noun.
Right.
So I have coined a word, which is kind of cool.
That's,
but to coin a word, you have to take that big risk, which is to be like, word you've never heard of. I am very sympathetic to the idea that if somebody had come up with a better title that sold more books, I would have been for it. I was not wedded to Ame Tora because when they told me I couldn't use it.
You've thought of something else. Yeah, yeah. No, but I just think it's an interesting element of the lives of books. I mean, I think a title does have a massive impact on that immediate perception. Word of mouth is powerful because it overcomes all the friction, right? So if like someone you trust is saying yeah. directly to you, this is interesting, go get it. It could be called Poopity Pants and like people are all going to buy it, right? It doesn't matter what it's called. But there's this whole other massive, giant universe of people that you have one millisecond to grab their attention. And if you throw something at them that is a complete brick wall of meaning, like they just bounce right off it, right? And I think that is something that people working on books, putting stuff out in the world, like that is kind of important to think about. It also depends on what your goals are, right, with
yeah,
the project.
My goal, which is not a mature goal, but my goal was like very much like the cool people will read this book. And
right.
that's
right.
the audience. And
right.
I think the cool people sounds a little too snobby, but just like people who are into this will be into this.
Right.
And I wasn't trying to convince. And that was what's so weird about being in People Magazine. And because like if you're in People Magazine and it's like a super duper gossipy thing,
right.
then sure, people will be into it. Like you can
right.
put the most obscure thing in People Magazine, but people who read People Magazine are going to be like, ooh, Ame Tora. How
yeah.
Japan saved American style. Got to pick that up. I mean,
right.
it will not connect. So,
but if it was called, you know, Blazer Samurais.
Yeah, you know, but that's the problem is like, I think 90% of the book titles that someone would have thought of would have been terrible.
Horrible.
Yeah, I'm also convinced with books, or I don't know about books, but with bands, that the Rolling Stones, you hear it once, you go, oh, stones that are rolling, or, oh, that's a reference to an old blues song. And the second time you hear it, you're like, oh, the Rolling Stones, the band with Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you stop thinking about the thing itself.
Sure.
Very quickly. And so,
sure. But you know, rolling and stones are both words that have meaning to people.
Sure. That's the, but, yeah.
I'm just kind of poking at it because I do think, like, whatever, these are big questions, right? Like, when you put, you know, a book like this out into the world. I think
now I'm thinking about, like, a new book.
Yeah.
supposed to have a bigger audience and be even bigger. And the thing that I am obsessed with is like the books that last forever in the world, like Das Kapital or like The Wealth of Nations,
very,
or whatever.
Very straightforward.
It's like just big, bold, huge title that is the thing that it is. Yeah. And the trend or the convention at the moment for a book is to have a clever title, like a very funny wordplay.
Yeah.
And then the subtitle is like,
he's like, that's the real thing. Yeah.
And so I don't know what the clever wordplay and then the thing is for my book, because I'm trying to write a pretty substantial book that I hope will be kind of almost like a reference book.
Sure.
And in that I would like a title that had some sort of weight to it and it isn't like a silly little phrase. So I don't know. Yeah.
I think Ame Toto works really well in Japanese. Like, I think that is actually a great,
if you're into American Truck Simulator.
If you love tractor trailers and jeans. No, but it's like so Japanese language ability contingent, because otherwise it's like Amatra. Like, if you look at that, if you look at the word in English,
yeah,
like you also don't know how to say it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think the fact that you've been so successful with this thing, despite the fact that like you were operating on these like principles of like no commercial interest,
right,
and like don't throw them a bone, anyone who might buy this book, that just shows how incredible the book is, because people have overcome all these self-inflicted, yes. I'm not going to be thinking about these things going, as I'm producing it. I'm just going to operate from this pure, I'm obsessed with this and I want to just share this obsession.
Right.
Which often doesn't translate into much accessibility.
No. And so what, I mean, my...
But this is a very accessible book once you get into it.
Yeah. I mean, look, the ego questions now that pop out of this, or the dilemma, is that, when I wrote this book, everyone's like, why? And good luck with that. Yeah, right. The four people who read it are going to love it.
Right.
And now it's sold over 50,000 copies worldwide.
Which is crazy.
And it's like, okay, like maybe I knew what I was doing.
Right.
And so then you go to the next book and it's like, people are like, who's going to read this? And like, why would you do that? Like, and so you get the same questions.
Right.
And it's incredible to me how much people are my friends. I'm going to sound a little bitter here, but like, I hope I never went to you and be like, why would you write a book about Kisa, Craig? Why would you do that?
Right.
Like, number one, you're already doing it.
Right.
But you're going to back out now.
Right.
Like, why don't people have more faith in other people that you have a vision for a thing and you want to see it out?
Right.
And especially when it's like, I just turned it into manuscript. I ain't going back. I don't need to hear about this. This was the wrong idea for
right,
a book.
Right, right.
So I, at this point, like, I do want feedback in the sense of like, I want to hear what a normal person thinks. Is it good? Is it bad? Should it be more this? It should be more that? Because I'm at the point with the new book where I'm going to, I'll get edits from my editor, but I could change things.
Like, sure.
If it's too dense, I can loosen it up or
sure.
Whatever. But at the same time, it's like, I have to have faith in myself and self-confidence that, oh, I did this even more niche last time
and it
did find an audience. And so for me, like the most important thing is just, I am the toughest reader of all my work and I edit the hell out of it. And if I get to a paragraph and I read it 10 times and I'm bored with it, then the something's wrong with it. It's gotta be readable to me 20 times.
Right.
And if I'm bored with that paragraph, it means the reader is very likely to be bored with it.
Well, also, I mean, I think about these things you're writing about, like you've spent decades building up this taste and it's like, you just have to have faith in that taste. If other people don't understand that immediately, they'll get it.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I do think we're in a culture, especially of on the internet. And I write about, and just for people out there, the new book that I'm writing is about social status and about how the individual desire for social status leads to behavior that in a group ends up forming what we know as culture.
Right.
And that is very...
That's the title of the book.
The whole thing. Yeah. And that's the subtitle is about a paragraph. But every chapter, basically what I look at is like, once you know this one principle, then it leads to another principle. So once you understand status and status pyramids, you can understand status groups. once you understand status groups, you can understand how conventions form in a group, like styles. And
very similar to the Zametora structure of like building and build, like this nested.
And then once you understand conventions, you can understand how people signal by showing that they're following a convention. And once you understand that, you understand taste. And once you understand that, you understand how people create identities.
Right.
And then, you know, so it's the same kind of thing. And with this book, which is about taste, first of all, so then I'm always questioning like my own taste, but you know, there is always a tension between things that are immediately understandable to everybody,
right,
and things that take time. And it's just like the human condition is that for most people, they are conditioned to understand the conventions that they have around them at that moment and everything else they reject.
Right.
And over time, those start to kind of bend a little bit and they start loosening up. And so in the 80s, like a band like the Pixies could do a sound, like a certain kind of song that, you know, was slow and they went really fast in the chorus, or it was just bass in the verse and then it got really hard in the chorus. And most people would be like, that is weird and I'm not listening to it. And then by the time those ideas are kind of floating around and then Nirvana does it and makes it way more palatable, then it becomes, you know, a very, very popular kind of thing, but still maybe with a small group. And then by the late 90s, like country music is doing the same thing. And so once you understand that process, and then you place yourself inside of it and you're like, okay, do I want to make the thing that is easily and instantly understandable?
Right.
Or do I make something that maybe at first is going to take some time and then people will finally get it? And I think people's personality and their goals in life put them on different things, because there's a lot of people who are like, I want to sell a ton of stuff. And I want to be an immediate winner and be a huge winner. And I want to have fans that adore the thing I do immediately.
Right.
And, you know, for me, it's like I grew up where on MTV, they'd be like, this video is a cult classic. And I was like, I want a cult classic. I mean, I would never have had the goal of like, I want to do this huge thing that people immediately get. And so I am very proud of that Amateur became a kind of cult book.
Yeah.
But we live in an era of both that there is no such thing as a cult thing. There's only something that has fewer numbers of people following them on social media platforms or fewer views. And it used to be that a weird movie that no one saw had like a cachet that was unrelated to its view count.
Right.
But now everything's view count.
Well, because it's all visible.
It's all like quantifiable, visible, comparable.
You'd go into Magic Video and you'd see Eraserhead on the shelf in the weird indie section, and you wouldn't know that only 100 people had watched it.
You know? Anyway, but you knew the image of Eraserhead was like this iconic movie. Yeah. And so you imagined everyone has seen this except for me.
Right, right. Hundreds of thousands of people.
And now it's like on a YouTube video, you can see like, oh, no one has seen this video.
It can't be good.
It can't be, it must be good. Where this one, this cat.
40 million.
So I think we live in a world in which the logic of making slightly, whether you call it niche or cult or whatever things, is on one hand less attractive or less understandable. But at the same time, it's like the thousand true fans theory stuff.
Sure.
If you do it the right way, obviously it can be very lucrative. So I don't know. So I sometimes these questions to me don't, maybe it's because I'm like the tail end of Gen X or I just grew up in an indie culture or whatever, I have a hard time sometimes understanding like, why are you asking me why I would do this? Like I do this because you got to do it. Like I don't have a choice. Like I've got to write the book that I'm going to write.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, in a way, there's a theological component to it. It's like, that's why we're alive. You have this consciousness. And it's like, why would I waste this on, you know, reprocessing something that's already been processed a million times, or like, putting something out there that's just derivative of what exists and is popular, because I know it'll be able to latch onto that and also be kind of popular. It's like, let's go a little deeper. Let's explore a little more.
Do Amateur a lot dumber. I mean, I think somebody would have written the book anyway, and it would have been a lot worse.
Do you think so?
I think they would have been something similar to it. Maybe it would have been like a photo book or something. But like, I think it would have just been a lot more bland. And, you know, because again, I write the books I want to read. Then I push myself like, it's got to be as, you know, detail rich as possible.
Sure, sure.
So the other funny thing is just like, I was talking to some a famous author in my world.
Right.
And I was like, for my next book after Amatora, I'm going to do this book about culture, which I wrote. And he's like, you know, it's good sometimes to write a book for yourself or for like kind of niche audience. But he gave me again the like, Like, you know, no one's going to read this. That's like, and then I sold it to Viking, you know? So it's like, this process is, it's so funny how pessimistic everybody is. And maybe it's like encouragingly pessimistic where it's like, David, you could do so much better. Why don't you write like this big thing? But it always comes like, I'm the person making these decisions. And so Everyone's always doubting like my decisions is never like,
but I think it is pleasant. But it is good. I think most people aren't necessarily gifted with good taste or like a perfect compass. Right. And so sometimes it is good to have that pushback. And even like with this next book you have coming out, you said that there was a moment where there's kind of this total revision of what it was about. And like that was probably helpful to have someone push back against it. So there's like, I think there are two ways to respond to people going like, hey, you're doing a weird thing. Do you really want to be doing that? It's like you have this third person perspective of like being self-critical and like cultivating that is really important. And it's just like, it's like temperature check, right? It's like, do I really want to be doing this? Is this the right shape of this project or, you know, yada, yada, yada. I think that is important because otherwise you get like Chinese democracy, right? Where it's like, like Axel, you should probably give up on this. It's right. Like, you know, 15 years later, you release a crappy album, right? And that's not good.
So to talk about the new book, yeah, I was trying to write it as what is the internal hidden logic of culture and how it works. And it was going to be a book about culture. And I just could not get anybody to think about it because the word culture is just too confusing. And then I started, the reason I kind of, you know, I just ripped it apart and tried to say, okay, I'm going to make everything just a one little blog post. What if it's just about 40 blog posts? And as I was writing it,
going back to realize,
I mean, it was. I was like, yeah. I love blogging. What if I just did it as blogs? And so I was rewriting the whole thing as blogs. And the first part was like defining culture, and it was so boring. It was just like so pedantic. And then I got to a whole section on status, and I was like, this is I did this. This is good.
Yeah.
And I tried to figure out, okay, how can I lead with that? How can I redo the book? And ended up putting all the same content in, more or less, but just finding a framing. And everyone was more interested in that. And I think that I'm fine to get negative feedback, and I'm fine to get people saying, have you thought about this? But I've got to then take that and say, is there something... If it hits something that I'm already feeling, I'm much more likely to do something with it. I think if it's like, if the general critique is an existential one or as a sense of like, I don't think the thing you're doing should exist. Right. It's like, that's not really useful critique to me because I've already made the decision.
Right.
I made the decision 5 years ago that I would like this thing to exist. So it doesn't help me to tell me this thing shouldn't exist.
Right. Right.
But I don't, also, if you told me like write a more popular book, I don't know how to do that. This is me trying to write the more popular book, right? does the world need more books? I mean, when I went to I think it's Blackwell's in Oxford.
Yes, it does.
Hold on. So I went to let me prove you wrong, Craig. I went to Blackwell's in Oxford, which is like Oxford, UK, a couple years ago, and it's like this giant. Like one of the world's biggest bookstores or something. But it's just like, there's so many books.
Yeah.
And you're like, why would I add to this? Like, there's so many more. And that pressure is on me though, to say, if I'm going to do something, it's gotta be something that doesn't exist already.
Sure.
And in reading, like for the book I'm reading now, which I've read like easily to my bibliography this time is like, it's over 200 pieces, you know, things now, and it will be more by the time I finish. But you know, that reading all those books, there's a lot of people who've written the same book over and over again.
Sure.
And it was very important to me that it's like, I only want to do this book if it is something new.
Well, I mean, I think that's the just being respectful of the audience, right? Because it's like, why would you put yet the same thing? I find the similar thing where it's like my impulse to read as much as I can about the stuff that I'm also writing about is to find like counter patterns, right? So like anti patterns or whatever. Like, there's a lot of people who've done a bad job, and once you start to tease apart why these things are failing, there's a failure of tone, a failure of perspective. It's like that reframes how you're going to attack whatever the problem is around the book, whatever the topic is. And I think that if you aren't doing that as a writer, then you're sort of disrespecting everyone involved in the process, right? You're sort of like the people who have written the other books, the readers who may be interested in your work and buy your book and your own time, yada, yada.
So you find it so painful. I think the hardest things I've read, like, I mean, I had to read some Immanuel Kant like that was hard. But like I read a couple of books that are similar to the book I'm trying to write,
right,
that are recent.
Right.
And it was just like, okay, here we go. I'm gonna get through all of this. It's like every page you're cringing. And then you get to the end of the chapter and you're like, oh, they failed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and then you feel like, okay, there's still a reason for me to write the book. But I had to read a couple of these books where every page it's like, this could, I could turn the page and this could literally just be the book I wrote.
Right, you're just,
you know, sweating, going through it and then realizing they came to the complete wrong conclusions.
Right.
And so it's, but it's encouraging to not read and be like, oh, that's done.
Yeah.
And that was pretty early in the process of saying, okay, I'm going to read this book. And then I saw someone just did it. And it's,
well, but probably, I mean, to be like fair to you, like your impulse to do these things is probably because you perceive a hole in that market. Yeah. Like, because you would have otherwise naturally come across the thing that solved this.
Well, I mean, and I have it in the intro now, which is literally like I spent 20 years.
Yeah, looking for this.
Book, and it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So I realized I got to write it because I just want a book that puts all this stuff together in one book that explains how does culture happen? How does fashion happen? Why, like how are art and fashion related? Like all these questions.
Yeah.
And, so much of the writing the book also was solving these things for myself in my head. Because I can't solve these problems without writing them out.
Sure.
So it's like, I have this written proof and hopefully it's also readable, but you know, that's the point of it. But at the same time, it's like, there was a couple of books that came out or that I discovered in the process of writing this new book that had what I thought were counter theses. And one of them was like a book that was about beauty and nature. And it was more or less, it's by this, his name is David Rothenberg, but it's a he's a art/evolutionary biology guy. And I'm very opposed to the idea that beauty is like innate in us from evolutionary biology reasons. And I think it's very socially and culturally created. And so I was like, aha, I'm going to read this book that's going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he doesn't even make that argument. Like the argument, I was like, you're going to make this argument that I'm going to tear apart. It's like, he doesn't even buy it. And I was like, oh, great. And I learned so much from that book. And it's like so much interesting stuff in there. And then there's, other people who are doing kind of research, which I don't 100% agree with. But, you know, it's like we're just arguing about the edges. And like, you know, 80% of it is useful to say, okay, like, I can't go this far and I shouldn't go this far, but here's where we can kind of agree.
But I also think like the ideal response to this finding of something that does maybe mimic or fall into the same, a very similar space of what you're trying to do shouldn't be one of deflation or fear. It should be like, great. That's fantastic that this exists. How can I build on this now? You know, because that's what the whole, what you're talking about here is like, how do you build on all of Ame Tora is about everyone building on each other, right? Over the course of 40 years to get to whatever is happening in Tokyo today, fashion wise.
At the same time, I do think it's a good instinct. I beat myself up on it all the time and maybe I take it too far, but I do think it is a good instinct to just push yourself to make sure at all times, like, you're trying to do something new.
Sure. No, absolutely.
You're not like just repeating the conclusions of other people.
But I think the trick is to not let it crush you. Like, because I think for a lot of people,
right.
For a lot of people, like that's the feeling that neuters them. That's why they don't do the work, right? Because it's like, oh, I can't do it. I can't beat this. I can't add something to this.
I'm so scared of writing something and then being either completely, oh, that was completely wrong.
Yeah.
Or realizing that it's been said in the same way, you know, or whatever it is. And so what it encourages me to do is to go read around whatever the problem is and just be like a completist.
Right.
And then I get more confidence over time, which like I've been trying to be a completist about this now and I can't find the one book that says there's a, you know, your thesis is completely opposite.
Right.
So it's good. It's encouraging over time, but I feel like that for me, it's a positive pressure to have that devil on my shoulder.
Sure.
You know, you could be wrong.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
But I'm sure for many people, it is prevents them from
writing one word.
You know, because I write everything on a typewriter, Craig.
If you don't use a typewriter,
it's not really writing.
It's not writing.
That's an inside joke because the other thing I've revealed to you is like, if it weren't for computer word processing, I would not be a writer.
I love that you're a Google Docs writer. Like, that's kind of amazing. Google Docs is great. I am a huge fan of Google Docs, honestly.
Google Docs is great for me. I like that I can sometimes edit on my phone.
Which is crazy. That's an insane thing that you say that I think is because like, it's not just like editing on a small device as being in and of itself a difficult, onerous process, but like the fact that you are actively not succumbing to the 800,000 like pornographic delights that are circling the opening of the document on the phone. Like a phone is just like this portal into everything that is not doing work.
I have a really hard time reading things on my phone.
Hard time.
Yeah. I just can't read articles,
but you can
I print them out.
But you can edit.
It's like I'm an old person.
How do you edit on the phone if you can't read on the phone?
Oh, I can, so if I get in the zone of like editing on my phone, I can do it. I just like if I like a Vox article, it's like I want to read that. I was like put like save for later.
Star.
Like the read later folder for me is always like the read never folder. But what to get through it, I'll actually go and print out all of them and then just sit there with a highlighter. I need the physical. But I would not recommend editing on your phone. The first draft, but it's great for the 10th draft.
Okay, because you're just looking for little lines.
And that is more doable. But I think for like last minute edits on things, I was definitely like, and I love the things that are scary, but I also love is like, I love the last stages of editing when you're just like just proofing and you're just making sure things are fine. You're not using the word ubiquitous twice in one paragraph and things like that. But, you know, just seeing it in a different format is helpful. And going, the other thing that's scary though, is you're like, okay, I finally got it to work. And then and now it's done. And then you read it again. You're like, oh, I got to redo it. But like I edit until I go through, until I can read it with some distance and not want to make any changes. I don't consider it done.
Yeah.
And that usually takes something like between 10 to 20 drafts.
Yeah. That sounds about right.
And you know, I think there's different, definitely different attitudes about this, and I saw someone complaining recently about this idea of writing as a sculpture. I mean, for me, it's like most definitely you throw the text in.
What do you mean they're complaining about it?
Somebody was like, their problem with writing these days is everyone's treating it like sculpture. They're cutting it down.
What are they talking about?
I don't know, but I do get a sense that like, and I don't know this for a fact, but when you see what the writing process was like for people before computers and like in the 1920s or something, I'm sure people were by hand writing one draft and doing like a second draft and then getting edits and being like, well, printing at the fourth draft. And I get a sense that there was probably more of a,
I think that we underestimate how much physical editing was going, like literally cutting paragraphs out and moving around. Like read the John McPhee essays about his process for writing his nonfiction stuff, like in the '80s where he didn't have a word processor. And then he actually had like custom word processor software made to like match his editing style. But if you read his old essays about what he did, it was extremely iterative. Mm-hmm. Like it really was. And I think that there's just like note cards and chopping and tape and like double-sided tape and like, you know, just moving things around. And like, you could kind of do it like we do on a word processor. It's just a little less fluent.
Right.
But the fact that you wrote everything in Google Docs does mean that.
What do you use? I mean, I don't think I'm weird on this either. Better to use?
Well, I think Google Docs is weird because you have to be online to do it, you know, and you don't have like a local copy save necessarily, and you're relying on Google, and it's like kind of a weird editor to a degree. It's not very minimal. It's, I don't know. There's a lot of options in there, but like, I think it's great. I mean, I love doing article back and forth with editors in Google Docs. I find that like, did you use Word? Did you convert to Word and then do?
Yeah. I mean, for this new one, I had to convert to Word.
You did.
They're going to edit in Word and send it back to me. So I don't
know. I don't understand why they can't all happen in Google Docs. Cause I feel like the track changes in Google Docs is way better than Word at this point. But I just use Ulysses to write drafts, and then, you know, if I have to collaborate with anyone, it goes into Google Docs eventually. I think it's great. But the interesting thing about you using Google Docs is that actually the entire history, keystroke by keystroke history of that book is in Google Docs. You realize that, right?
Yeah, except for at some point I would like, well, probably like chapter 4.
Yeah.
For example, exists is on Amateur chapter 4. There's a doc for that.
Yeah.
I saved off before I like did the Jurassic cuts.
Yeah.
I saved off another version.
Sure.
But I think the final one is probably in that.
Yeah. Well, no. So there's software that can play back your writing history.
Right.
Keystroke by keystroke.
Yep.
And you can speed it up or whatever. So like what's interesting about like what's interesting about this is like, we talk about like, oh, like in the olden days, people had drafts and like you saw them do all the markups and everything. But like actual digital stuff, we have, if you write it in Google Docs, an even more granular history of the thought process of like the genesis of that chapter or whatever. Anyway, it's kind of interesting. Historians in 200 years will be able to play back in real time.
I mean, I don't want people reading my terrible first draft.
Well, they'll be able to. They can do it.
Publish it by then. So
it's instructive.
I mean, I feel in life at this point too. It's like when I say things, I'm like, that's only my first draft of the thing I said.
Right, right.
Give me 12 more attempts at this. I often don't feel like a lot of people want to grow up to be writers. And I certainly wasn't. And I was not a good reader until after college. Right.
And what made you a good reader? What does that mean to be a good reader?
Just like reading. Or like wouldn't just like float off in the middle of a paragraph.
Right.
You know? And then just be like, did I read any of that? Because like, I'm just like thinking about other things.
Right.
And the difference was at college, a couple of things happened, which is I got into like, I guess I got into Hunter Thompson.
Okay.
And I realized like, oh, they just have all the books at the library. And I know that's not on my like curriculum, but I can just go get them and read them.
Right.
So I would like do joy reading or like read about weird stuff like that I was interested in and just get the books and they have everything. So, you know, doing that. And then after college, I realized like if you're reading a boring book, you can just skip it or like stop or, you know, there's no test.
Yeah,
right. And so
yeah.
It was the first time I was like, I can just read if I want to read and read what I want to read. And then after college, when I was in New York, the public library system was like the greatest thing in the world. And so I would just order all these dream books that I had heard of and wanted to read. And then they would get them delivered to my local branch and I would go pick them up. And then just like on the subway every day, just like tear through. And so
right.
Read tons of Tom Wolfe and, a lot of like Philip Roth novels and, you know, just catching up on a lot of that. And then since then I've just been obsessed But for a long time, I also had access to a library. And I think what's been hard about being in Japan out of
the U.S. library system.
The U.S. library system, but also the university library system, because the Japanese universities have great English language libraries,
right.
Is that there's nowhere to get these books I want. And a lot of academic books are like $120 new or more. I mean,
right.
It's a lot. And so I am obsessed with used book hunting.
Right.
And so... And also bargain used book hunting to an embarrassing degree. So I probably come home with something like 3 to 5 books a week.
Right.
English that are like anywhere from novels to obscure things. They're just anything like I would like to read that at some point. And the average price of a book I buy is probably something like $2 to $3.
Right.
And my room is now filled with probably 200 unread books,
right.
If not more,
right.
That are just like filling every space because it's like, I'm going to get to that book on game theory and language really
right.
soon.
Right.
I just got to get through these other 200. And then in my basement, the thing I did last year was I bought a lot. I forgot how to buy lots of books as in a lot,
yeah.
Not lots.
Yeah.
Of books bundled from this kind of warehouse in, somewhere in East Tokyo,
okay.
That they put things on Yahoo auctions, and so it'll just be like a lot of Western books. And I found one. I found five that were kind of similar lots, and I ended up paying $70, and then the shipping was maybe like another $70 because they're
okay.
So heavy.
Yeah,
and I got 420 books.
Right.
I was trying to figure out. I was like, I'm sure a professor has passed away. And this is his library.
Yeah.
Because it was all anthropology, sociology books.
Right.
And there was at least like 100 in there I wanted.
Right.
And so I got this and, you know, I fortunately have a basement that I can put a lot of these in. But I opened it up and I started looking through it and then I found the professor who it was.
Right.
And he was an anthropologist at Keio University and
right.
passed away last year. And that was his library.
Wow.
And so I got something like 400 of these old paperbacks. And at least 5 to 10 of them, I have found incredible and valuable insights for my new book that no one ever would have told me they were
sure.
there.
Sure.
And that's so the serendipity of also like a lot of the ideas and things I found in, especially for this new book, it's a crazy process.
But I think that serendipity component, that's like a really big part of most book writing from what I can tell. I mean, even like novels, like if you get into deep novel mode, it's like anything that happens around you or anything you read or run into is feeding through this novel filter. Like, can it be added to that world or can it be, you know, can it sort of amplify something in that world? But I mean, just listening to the story now that you talk about this lot of books that you got, that's like, you're so excited about, like you can't not do these things. That's why you're writing these books. Yeah. That's why you're like there's very few people out there who's like, who would be like, oh, I just got this box of 400 books that like, you know, is unfiltered and I have to like dig through and there might be some gems in there and it's all sociology books and it's like a professor's library. And like most people would not, would be like, that's a burden. That's why they were selling it as a lot of books. But it's great that you found 5 to 10 important ideas in there. But like that just goes to show you like that's the book you should have been doing. That's the project. Like you were fully into it. You were fully in that project.
Yeah. And, you know, I had somebody reading the new book and the feedback was like, these examples are so random. Right. Like from where are you getting this stuff? Right. Like why? Right. And, you know, I think that I had something in the intro that I maybe was missed, which was like I'm intentionally pulling from as many random places as possible to show you how universal these principles are.
Right.
Because what I want to show you is like the principles of taste and status and culture and all these things apply to dogs.
Right.
How we choose our dogs. They apply to the pens that we use. They apply to coffee brewing mechanisms, like any, all these things, like all these things, especially when we say like, no, they are all practical.
Yep.
It's like, no, there's a status component. And so, I'm pulling from all these crazy places, but you know, I'm actually intentionally trying to find the examples that are as off the wall as possible, as long as I can kind of double check them.
Sure.
And there's one that I, you know, I probably will go in the book that I'm like really on the fence about, which is Marshall McLuhan has an example where that he quotes from somebody that an African king had been watching. This is like in the 20s or 30s, been watching a Hollywood movie, and there's a barber's chair, like a big white barber's chair in the movie, and the king ordered that to be his throne.
Okay.
Because he saw it in the movie, and then this African king is using a barber's chair as his throne.
Right.
Which is an incredible story. I just can't find any other verification for this other than like it's mentioned in Marshall McLuhan, and I don't trust McLuhan also enough to be like, oh, he definitely double checked this.
Right.
But you know, there's like things like that. You just want to find the most fascinating anecdotes that no one's seen before.
Right.
And that requires you to read a lot of crazy things. And so when I see a book at the bookstore that's like growing up in the deep South in the 1940s, you're like, yes, just be like something. If I have the patience to go through this.
Right. Right. Well, and I think that that's the feeling you get reading On My Toyota too, is like, there is a lot of things coming in each of the chapters, like these quotes and other, it just feels like, not in like an obvious oppressive way, but it's like a lot of work has gone into this. Someone didn't just kind of like hear a couple of anecdotes and write them up. Clearly this person has rigorously read around this subject, and you feel like there's a kind of authority and comfort there in knowing this is probably all I'm ever going to need to read on this. Like I've got it.
Yeah, which is, I told you this a couple of years ago and you were like, why? But I did this thing where I would, so someone in Amatora would be like, here's how I bought jeans for the first time.
Yeah.
And I was like, great, I got the story. And I would write it up. But it's like, I just need a little more. And so I would try to find that person's interview.
Yeah.
And I would read, because these people are interviewed over and over again throughout the years.
Sure.
For like the 30th anniversary issue, let's talk again about how you found jeans. And they would tell the story slightly differently. And there would be like two or three new pieces of information in that. And I would go back and add it. And because I'm just obsessed with motive.
Sure.
And a lot of times people don't talk about motive. Sure. And then you're like piecing it all together saying, I'm trying to explain why things happen. Like they don't quite explain. I think that this is why, but they're not saying it.
Yeah.
And what's really cool is when you're like, I think it's this, and they don't say it. And then you find the interviewer like, oh, it's that. And you're like, I deduced the thing it was. But if I could do it, I'd read the same story told by a person four times.
Right.
So that I would have the absolute authoritative, perfect.
Well, the overlap of those four stories is the perfect
version. Yeah. Or just the one that it adds in all the details of all the four. But that's, I mean, yes, a normal person probably wouldn't do that. And I'm not saying it's a better book because, you know, I do that. But it's like, to me, that is what makes my books, I'm talking about as if there's multiple ones so far, but like makes that book at least super dense and rich.
Sure.
I remember turning in my thesis in college. One of the professors says, it's a bit of an information overload, which it is. And my books are. But, you know, people, when they write me and say, hey, I've read your book three times.
Yeah.
Or whatever. That's, I think that's what you're reading for.
You're getting more out. Yeah,
you
yeah.
get more out from that overload. And I have been reading a couple of academic books recently on topics I'm interested in. And I remember how much just what I would call pablum there is, or boilerplate. It's sure. just like there's, you have a paragraph and yeah. there's one idea, there's yeah, one example.
Sure, sure.
And it's just like writing stuff like, yeah, you know, I know yeah. that this thing is true. And it's not even like I'm making academic writing or academic ideas, that's fine. But there's just so much padding.
Yeah.
And I think the number one thing is like, I just want a zero padding book. That sure. is every idea, every sentence is representing a unique idea.
Right. Which, yeah, I could see how some people would find that overwhelming.
Yeah.
But.
and that's the thing. Is like, my books probably don't have breathing room.
Right.
And
but from there.
Is the breathing room.
But from there, it's like, I think it's probably easier to add in a little bit of breathing room. And the editors can help with this.
When I was a CNN editor for their website, the thing that I realized is I'd have two categories of writers. I'd have people who turned in grammatically perfect, bland pieces.
Sure.
And then I'd have like really grammatically horrible pieces filled with rich detail.
Yeah.
And I could always edit those to be wonderful, but I can't edit in detail. And yeah. so, you know, for me, it's just like, I start with the density.
Right.
You know, I used to make music, and the whole conceit of the music I made too, is that it was condensing as many ideas as possible into the fewest amounts of music, minutes as possible.
Right.
So like my first thing I did was a EP that was 19 minutes and like 12 songs.
Right.
And it's like 10 different genres.
Right.
And even within the same song, it flips from two different genres. Like, so there is something about my brain that it's like very hungry for
density.
And because my feeling is you can always repeat.
Sure. Sure. Sure.
But you know, I think filmmaking, for example, the most epic and beautiful films are sometimes the ones where they're sparse and open, and it's probably not a good skill that I have.
Right. The opening of 2001, you'd have been like, well, we could just speed this up a little. Yeah.
That's good. Just tell me about this.
Anyway, Amitore is great. I had so much fun going back to it. And I can't wait for this next book because I feel like I still have so many questions that will only be answered through this next book. Like, I feel like these are going to be good companion books. It's like the second one's going to kind of unlock a lot of the motivation and secrets of the first one.
What I hope is the new book is the universal blueprint.
Sure.
That explains any book that's a cultural history or any book right. that is about trends.
That's a very low goal you have for this new book.
I mean, why do it if it's not a universal
blueprint? Right.
Like, I don't need to tell you a principle about how fashion worked in the 60s in Japan.
Right.
Like, that's not.
Right. You can abstract that. Yeah.
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 And that's the whole point of why the book I'm trying to show that the use of the color purple under Emperor Nero.
Yeah.
And We Rate Dogs, the Twitter.
Yeah.
Channel, and the Beatles haircut.
Yeah.
There are universal principles that operate under all of these
right.
kind of things.
Well, I can't wait. When that comes out, spring 2022.
That is the hope.
Cool. Anyway, thanks, David.
Thank you.
That's it. That's a wrap. Thank you, David, for being such a rigorous investigator and spelunker into Japanese culture and for sharing that curiosity with the world through your writing and books. As I said in the intro, today's episode is made possible by Special Projects memberships. If you like the episode and you want to throw us a bone, you can do that at craigmod.com/membership. Thank you for that. Today's episode was also sponsored by Freakishly Cold and Rainy Summers. You think summer has come to claim your soul in Japan, and then suddenly, in the middle of August, blammo, you got to break out your friggin' sweaters and turn off the AC and turn back on the Toto washlet heated toilet seats. And everything is backwards and nothing makes sense in the world because it's August 14th and you're thinking about a long, hot bath to soak away the depressive feels of a week of nonstop torrential downpours. So, thanks, climate change, maybe, and strange weather patterns for keeping us all on our toes and keeping us here in Japan cool during what is otherwise a literal hell known as summer around Tokyo.